Thanks to the ladies who did the breakfast. That was great. I hope you're back in here. That was really good. And thank you for, on a Saturday morning, getting up early and cutting up all those bits of fruit. We really appreciate that. It's great to be with you. And just to say why I'm going to be speaking about what I'm going to be speaking about, when Fiona asked me about this, I immediately wanted to come because it seems a long while since I've seen a lot of you, and it's great to just renew that friendship and that contact again. So I appreciate that. I woke up in the middle of the night. Normally when I wake up in the middle of the night and thinking about sorts of what I've got to do in the morning, or, you know, or worrying about something, or thinking, why aren't I asleep, or not another trip to the loo, or whatever it might be. And this particular night I woke up, and I just felt, this has never happened before, I just felt the Lord say, I want you to speak about friendship. And I thought, friendship, that's a little bit low-key, isn't it? What about something a little bit deeper than that? And I started to think, I thought, you know, particularly those of us in the church, we can forget that we actually need to be friends. That we're so busy doing things and relating to one another on teams, and you had a team working this morning, and that's great, and we get on with the business, but we forget the value of friendship, that we don't just need people around us, but we actually need to relate deeply to one, two, three, however many. And we need that. There is a deep need within us. You know, we're not meant to be alone. And it was this sort of feeling that I had, and I thought, perhaps it isn't such a shallow thing after all. Perhaps it's actually something that we all have a deep need for, but we just don't talk about so much. So that's the background to why I'm speaking about friendship. What happened to me one day, and the reason why I am convinced of this, is not because I read it in a book or anything. I was in a very difficult period of my life, and my personality was changing because of it. And it was a stressful situation, and I will tell you about that situation later on in the story. But what happened as a result of this was that I didn't understand why I was feeling like I was feeling. And I just was shocked at myself. And things, it was a new experience for me. I'd always been very positive, and I was becoming negative, and I couldn't find happiness. I just could not find happiness. And I'd always been happy all my life. And I hit this period of my life, and Dave came home from a trip, and Dave, in his nice, gentle, pastoral way, said, for goodness sake, Chris, get this sorted out. Go and ask God what's wrong with you. Because I don't know what's wrong. You don't know. Go and ask God. Well, I was very heavily pregnant at the time. And I suddenly thought, oh, yes, what a good idea, you know. But felt very sorry for myself that I was expecting my husband to have all the answers and to have loads of sympathy, and he, I was beginning to try and open up to him, and he just says, just go and get with God, you know, and don't come down till you've found out what's wrong with you, sort of thing. So I was very heavily pregnant and sort of waddled up the stairs feeling very sorry for myself, knelt down by the side of the bed, and I remember saying, God, what is wrong with me? And I instantly had a picture in my mind. And it was of a really old-fashioned Victorian-looking type little girl with, you know, the long, curly, blonde, curly hair and the bit taken back with a big ribbon and a frilly little dress, standing in a playground with her head down, saying, I haven't got a friend. And I looked at that picture and I thought, that can't be me. I'm a married woman. I'm expecting my third baby. What is wrong? That can't be me. And it was one of those things that it so much couldn't have been me that I knew it must have been God telling me it was me, because I couldn't have made that up. And I saw this image of this little girl saying, I haven't got a friend. So I marched downstairs again, huge, down, and I go in, and tears streaming down my face, and I say to Dave, I haven't got a friend. And his eyes went out on stalks. He said, what? I said, God's shown me. I haven't got a friend. And And I can't remember any more of that conversation. I don't know if we just left it there or what. But an amazing thing happened. And I'm going to tell you that amazing thing later on in the story. Because I want to go back to the beginning that led, the thing that led up to that moment. Just before I do that, I just want to see if you recognise this sort of life. I'm just going to read something out of the book here. The age in which we live is a little bit like this. Oops. This is the age of the half-read page, and the quick hash and the mad dash, the bright night with the nerves tight, the plane hop with the brief stop, the lamp tan in a short span, and the brain strain and the heart pain, and the cat naps till the spring snaps and the fun's done. And the person who wrote this book on friendship always has that poem, because it's basically saying that in the fast pace of the life that we lead, we forget that friendship and fun is important. We know more about computers than we do about caring for others or for a friend. We, as a nation, probably have more of a relationship with the characters in Coronation Street than we do with Jesus Christ. We can have 1,000 friends on Facebook, but never ever see them face to face or even hear their voice. We have more people living on their own than any other time in history. And relationships, even marriage relationships, but relationships in general, are so transient, so much movement, people moving around, that many people feel lonely and isolated. We've forgotten friendship. Some of you know a friend of ours who lives in Sweden, in need of a church there called Håkan. And some of you will know this story, but I think it must have been probably about 4 years ago now, something like that. Håkan had a house fire, and he was very, very badly burnt in that fire. And he was airlifted to hospital, and they found out that he'd got, I think it was something like 80% burns, and they were graded quite deep, severe burns. And he was totally wrapped up like a mummy. It was just horrendous. He's recovered. And he's recovering and having many, many operations, and he's come through this. And his wife actually saved his life, because he was so disorientated that he was going to go down into the basement to try and get out instead of out through the front door. And she realised, and she went back into this house that was on fire. And she's not big, but her husband is big. And she actually hauled him up from the basement steps and took him outside, and he was literally on fire, standing outside in the middle of the night. Horrendous, horrendous situation. Though, you know, it's impossible that he lived. And when they got to the hospital, I don't know if it was the very first question, but one of the first questions they asked was, has this man got a supportive family? And has he got supportive friends? And they said, oh yes, very much so. He's a leader of a church. He's surrounded by people who care. And the consultant said, he stands a chance. That was the key to life. The fact that he had relationships with people who were going to support him and stand with him through this. And we know the power of prayer is very, very powerful too. And he's come through, and it really is a miracle. So I think it's important that in our busyness of life, that we actually make time for friends. And I can feel guilty. If I'm sitting just having a cup of coffee with somebody in the day, and Dave will come in and say, what have you been doing today? I mean, like, I feel really guilty if I say, well, I had coffee with so-and-so. I did this last week. I said, oh, the day's not worked out at all, how I imagine. I had coffee with so-and-so in the morning, and I had coffee with so-and-so in the afternoon. And he said, great. Great. But can we feel that free? That we can just go and have fun with one another, and friendship, and love one another, and be together? because I think it's not the icing on the cake in life. I think we need it. I think it affects our mental health. I think it affects our physical health. We need that kind of friendship with each other. And the other thing that's important is that if we can have this within our church, our churches, then how much easier is it going to be that we can love people outside? How much easier is it going to be when the stranger walks into our group that we have that culture of friendship and we can extend that friendship because we understand it and we practice it, because it doesn't happen overnight. It's things we have to work at. So I think it's twofold that I think we need that. You've got little bits of pink paper on your table, and this is, before we go any further, I'd like you to do something. I'd like you each to think of a friend, someone you would call a friend, either past or present, it doesn't matter. Somebody who you think of and you think, yeah, that person showed me friendship or shows me friendship. And I'd like you just to think of one characteristic that makes that person a friend to you. And I'd like you to write it down on the one piece of paper, and somebody on your table will feedback what you've all written. Okay? Doesn't matter if it's repeated. Even if it was all the same, let's just hear it, so that we know what the kind of relationship we're talking about. Okay? So I'll just give you a couple of minutes to do that. Okay. Right, let's start with this table. Oh, quick. Oh, you've got a big table, that's why. We'll come to you last, don't worry about it. We'll start here.
Okay. Unconditionally supports me, texts regularly, hugs regularly, also supports, love and praise, is caring and loyal.
Very good. Wonderful things, yes. Support, loyal. I'm just repeating a few just in case it didn't record. Hugs me. Was that one of them?
Yes.
Hug. Yeah. Yes, okay. Sometimes it just takes a hug. Okay, next table.
Reliable and loves me unconditionally.
Yes.
Forgives. Loves me regardless. Never judgmental. Mm. Interested in me. Mm. Unconditional, non-judgmental love. Loyal and honest.
Loyalty comes out strongly. Non-judgmental love, yes, amazing. Right, Deirdre and Helen's table, let's hope so.
Fun, caring, yeah. Loving, reliability, yeah. Faithful, and needy.
Needy. Very good. That's an interesting one, isn't it? I think, you know, if I understand whoever said that, it's not a good friendship if it's all one way. It's not a good friendship if you are unburdening to someone. It's a counselling situation. It's a support, and it's good, very good. But a friendship is two-way. It's where they, you know, there's somebody who also has needs from time to time who is prepared to open up to you as well. So that's what I would think probably somebody's saying there. Table at the back.
Fills me up to see how I am.
Mm-hmm.
Good listener. Keeps confidences, trustworthy, and I'm able to be myself.
Yeah, wonderful things. Able to be yourself fully. Able to be yourself, loyal, trustworthy, keeps confidences. The first way to ruin a relationship is not to keep the confidences that you should have kept, because trust is broken and it takes a long time to build trust. It's like a big bridge that has to be built, so it doesn't happen overnight. And if you do that and betray a confidence, it can break it overnight. But then, to be honest, you just got to go back and say, I'm really sorry, I shouldn't have said that. Please, would you forgive me? It doesn't mean it's the end of the friendship. And, you know, friendships can be stronger when you actually do something wrong and you have to work it through, or you've upset one another and you choose to actually work it through together. You can really make it stronger. So, yeah, very good. This table.
Listener, goes the extra mile.
Yeah.
Assistant, rings up and looks out for me. Trustworthy and honest, always there. There for me in everything. Mm. Constant,
they're always there. Yes, rings me up. It's great when somebody rings you up, because you think, oh, they must have been thinking about me at that moment to do that. It's not the phone call so much as the fact that somebody is actually thinking about you and caring about you. Some of you find it very easy to pick up the phone. Some of you find it very difficult to pick up the phone. Some people just find it difficult to use the phone. Sometimes you just have to say, no, I will do it, or I will go and visit, or whatever, just to show that you're thinking of them. Next table.
Patient, time for me,
non-judgmental,
consistent, supportive, and always ready for chat.
Always ready for chat. That's lovely. That's great. Consistent, loyal. Millie, you've got one?
Faithfulness, unconditional acceptance, unconditional love, honesty, good listener, and love and faithfulness.
Yes, good listener. Next table.
Good neighbour, takes me as I am, listens and cares.
Yeah.
Faithful, generous and patient, chatting together, sharing what's going on, always got time, fun, talks easily.
Talks easily, fun, always got time. Yeah, that's great. This table?
Faithful, would call unexpectedly, kindness, warm, always there, remembers things that have happened to me over the years, caring availability, makes me laugh.
Wonderful things. It's not rocket science, is it? You know, like these things, they're all things that every single one of us can give. Yes, there's a cost factor. We have to want to give that. Some of us find it easy and some of us don't. But I think there's nothing there that we can say, oh, I could never do that. We could all keep a confidence. We could all give a hug. We could all make a phone call. We could. It's possible for every single one of us. If we were talking about moving in miracles or being prophetic or being a teacher or like these things, some of you would say, oh, well, that's not me. But this is for every single one of us. And if every single one of us can grow in this area, think of the culture that we would have amongst us if we were able to give friendship easily on all sorts of different levels. I think it could revolutionise who we are. Having said this, I must say, some of you are absolutely brilliant, and you could do a better job speaking about this than I ever could, because you are just great. The people who've come up to me this morning and the people who've opened up their hearts already and said how they really are, these are precious things. And I know, I don't think I'm telling you something that you're not doing. But it's just hopefully encouraging you to go deeper. So all those qualities and things, I know Jesus didn't pick up the phone and ring, but most of those, Jesus is a great model, isn't he? He's strong, caring and reliable. He met people where they were. There's a lot about being loved unconditionally there and accepted unconditionally. Jesus did that. He draws us up while never condemning us. I wonder if we could learn to do that with each other, or we could draw one another up without condemning each other. And same with the people outside. Can we draw people up who aren't Christians, who are in a terrible mess? Can we draw them up without condemning them? Can we talk to the homosexual without him feeling condemned? This is hard, isn't it? Jesus knew how to do that, to never leave people feeling bad. He didn't do that, but he never compromised. I think we need more of that, where we leave people feeling, I'm glad I spoke to them. And yet, they're in a better place than they were when we started. That's what Jesus does. He helps us when we're down and turns our troubles into triumphs. Promises never to leave us or forsake us. And we had something there about perseverance and never giving up on us. He has a greater vision for us than we have for ourselves. So he sees you better and further on the road and more glorious than you see yourself. I wonder what it would be if we saw the people that way. But we get bogged down with all the things that we see outwardly or the things that they do that really annoy us. And we don't see that wonderful glories beyond who they are. And I don't always do that, but that's what Jesus does with us. And I think, wow, to be like that. Jesus went with Zacchaeus to his house. I think there's something special about inviting people into your home. And I'm not so good at this, to be honest. And I think I'm not so good at it because I think it's got to be perfect before I invite people in. That's terrible. What, you mean you understand that? Great. It's not just me. And I think I've got to do a 3-course meal from MasterChef, you know, before I say come round for dinner. But some of the best times I've had with friends has been the spontaneous thing. And there's some of the best things that I've done with friends, and it's been no pressure. I mean, that's putting myself under pressure. And I've got the time, you know, I'm looking at the clock and I'm working through it, I'm looking through recipe books and all the rest. But the times when I've just said, come around and just come and have what we have, they've been the most fun times and the most freeing, relaxing times. Some of you will understand that and some of you think differently, but I wish I could do a little bit more of the spontaneous thing. And yeah, but Jesus went to Zacchaeus' house and that meant a lot. And to be in one another's homes, I think, says so much. And it doesn't have to be perfect. That's entertaining, it's not hospitality. We had a young couple that came to our church about, I don't know, 2-3 years ago now, and from Africa, from Nigeria, I'm not sure. And we just spontaneously invited them back for Sunday lunch. And they came, and they'd been around, they'd been in the country for quite a few years, and it was the first home they'd ever been in. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. And it turns out he's a prince in his nation. And they were absolutely fascinating. They were wonderful. I benefited by getting to know them. And it's inviting people back. Jesus did that with Zacchaeus. He invited himself into his home because he didn't have a home. Jesus didn't have a home. But he said, I'm coming to your home. And the woman caught in adultery, he showed love and mercy to her. And with Lazarus and Mary and Martha, he had a place. I'm ever so glad for that relationship that he had with them, that Jesus had a home he could go to and he could kick off his sandals and put his feet up and just be himself. Although there were times, we know the stories that happened there, that he was on duty raising the dead and speaking to Mary and Martha. But how wonderful that Jesus had a home like that. George Eliot, the authoress, says, friendship is the inexpressible comfort of feeling safe with a person, having neither to weigh thoughts nor measure words. You can just be you. That takes time, but isn't it wonderful if people know that they can just be themselves with us? Yeah. That we're not going to judge them because they're not this or they are that. But you can be 100% yourself. Oh, that's just freedom. In relationship, we can nurture that. So I just want to go through four of my friends, and I'm talking about this from having received wonderful friendship from people, and I just want to introduce them to you. Some of them you all know. The first one is Mary. See if the right face comes up. This is an unusual friendship. It goes right back to the 70s, and in fact I can't talk too much about it and describe it because I do believe it's like a soul joining. It was like she and I just are together on things. And God called us to live communally together, she and her husband and Dave and I. So we, both couples sold their houses and we lived in this great big house together. Now can you imagine having two women for 7 years sharing a kitchen? And I can honestly say we never once fell out. It's just, that can only be God, can't it? And we had, I think of the relationship, lots of laughter. She's great fun. She's much more spiritual than I am. It was through her prayers and Jeff's prayers. That's her, some of you know her. They prayed us into the kingdom. They knew we didn't know Jesus. And we went to the church that they went to, Methodist church, but they knew we didn't know Jesus. And they started to pray for us, and we came to the Lord, and it was, I'm going to heaven because of her. And then God would have probably done it another way, but you can't make those sort of relationships happen. And we had to live by faith, so we would often, six of us, the two girls that were with us as well, we would pray in the money. And we had to pray for a mortgage because no building society would give us a mortgage because we wanted to live communally. And they just thought we were nutters, which we were. And, you know, the fridge didn't work, so we'd lay hands on the fridge because we didn't have money to get a new one. And, like, lots of supernatural stuff happened in those days. But I went through probably one of the most painful things that I've gone through, and that is that I couldn't have children. It just didn't happen. And Jeff just used to wink at Mary and she'd get pregnant. She's got five, and twins. And, you know, like, there was this pain going on that she was the one I shared with. And so she saw me cry. She couldn't do anything. She just stood with me and just shared in what I went through. We shared pains and sorrows. But there were lots of funny things as well. And I know Mary's, if this is recording properly, Mary's going to hear this. But Mary, have a laugh again at this. Just remember the good times. In those days, blue tack was the latest thing. And her husband was actually a chemist, and he did chemistry, and he one of the things he studied was adhesives. And he used to laugh that the answer to everything was blue tack. It became a bit of a family joke that needs sticking down. And Mary and I'd go, "Oh, blue tack." Well, we had these people round for a meal one night, and Mary has not got finesse. She covers masses in her life and works like a workhorse, but the detail and finesse are not really her forte. And she was making the Charlotte Russe, and Mary poured in the middle bit, and the Russe biscuits around the outside were just collapsing all over the place, and the people were in the other room. This was between courses, and she said, "I don't know what to do. I've poured this in and it's hot and it's melting all those biscuits." So we looked at one another and we went, "Blue tack." So she said, "Right, I've got some." So she went off and got blue tack, and the tops of the biscuits that hadn't melted and disintegrated, she blue tacked them all together. I said, "Mary, you can't, what are you doing?" We were killing ourselves laughing. And she says, "It's all right, I'll just avoid the blue tack when I serve it." And that is so, so typical of the kind of things we got up to. And I'll just tell you one more. Apparently, although we're from different parts of the country, we talk the same, we sound the same. And we sound exactly the same on the phone. We'd ordered a carpet, and I think I'd given my name, but it was for the house, it was for all of us. And I was out of the house, and the carpet people phoned, and she picked up the phone, and she started chatting. "I'm talking to you, I'm just phoning about the carpet just to let you know it's in." "Oh, great, that's really great." She said, "I really need to speak to Mrs. Richards." So she said, "Just one moment," put the phone down, and we had wooden stairs. She marches up three or four stairs, marches down again, picks up the phone and says, "Hello." That is typical Mary. And what happened next was we moved away from that. I phoned her last week to ask her for a photograph, and she agreed to send a photograph. And she said, "Are you anywhere near your computer?" I said, "I'm upstairs in my bedroom having a cup of tea." She said, "Well, I'm upstairs in my bedroom having a cup of tea." And that's the way it works with Mary. I phone her and I say, "God's been doing this." She said, "That's very strange. God's been showing me the same thing." You can't manufacture those sort of relationships, but I just want to say thank you to Mary for being such a good friend going through thick and thin, and for all the laughter that we've had. We still meet up from time to time, by the way. Well, then we moved up to Eastwood near Nottingham. And this is where that story comes in that I started with. The little girl, the loneliness. And I only realised in recent years that I think I got depressed. I didn't recognise it as such, but I think that's what happened. And it's because I'd been taken out of community and that kind of relationship into a small group where I couldn't seem to relate to people. There were too many differences. Like, it's great we need to relate to different people, but it was like it was too much for me. And I think I'd gone into this incredible grieving that I had lost this friendship where we'd shared life together. And then that story comes in about the little girl. Now, I'll tell you something amazing. God is an amazing God, and he supplies our needs. I'd come to that realisation that I needed a friend, and I hadn't got the friend I had. And suddenly, out of the blue, someone started to phone me. And this is Hillary. And Hillary, it's not a brilliant photograph, Hill. Sorry about that. But she, I knew her from London years earlier. And she was leading, they were leading a little church there, and Dave and I were involved with them. And then our part, we just lost touch with each other. And for no apparent reason, she started to phone me. And she phoned and phoned and phoned. I don't think I even explained the story. And it was enough, because she understood me. We just had good conversations. I was pregnant with my third. She was pregnant with her third. There was that link there. And she became a phone friend. And it's interesting, somebody said this morning, you know, just pick up the phone. Don't think that's nothing. It is something, and it can be really, really important in somebody's life, just to pick up the phone. And we went through a great time just chatting on the phone. Then it's probably my fault. I'm prepared to sort of, you know, say it's probably my fault. We sort of lost touch again after that, until just over a year ago. And I heard through another friend that her son, a grown-up son, she's got three boys, had got very serious cancer, and got skin cancer. And I remembered what she meant to me when I was in a dark time. And I had just such a longing in my heart just to be able to give back to her what she'd given to me. And so we started to phone, and her son died. He died exactly a year ago last week. And we're on the phone, not every day, but we're on the phone occasionally. And I can't do anything to bring her son back. But I can just phone and say, Hillary, I love you, and I'm just sending my love, and we're praying for you. And it's like a relationship is really deep. It's really strongly there, even though it's come and gone and ebbed and flowed over the years. Just by being there, I cannot say anything that will make a difference. I can be unjudgmental and I can just listen, but I can't do a lot more. But I think it's becoming quite important that our relationship has been renewed again. And she has been a gift to me, and I just hope that just by phoning I can be a gift to her. Just this thing about being there. Do you know you can avoid people in the street because you know they've lost somebody, somebody's died, or you don't know what to say, and you can avoid them. If you're anything like me, you've done that because you think, I don't know what to say. I just want to release you from that. That you don't have to say anything at all. It's better, don't make anything up. Don't say anything superficial, because it's deeper than that. But you can just look them in the eye and say, I've been thinking about you, how are you doing? And an arm around. And that means so much. And this thing about making a difference just by being there. I'm going on a bit, aren't I? Sorry about that. I'll try not to take too long. There's a story about a guy called Norman Cousins. You won't know that name at all. He's an author and a professor in California. And he was asked to speak to 70 or so patients who were dying of cancer. And they were sitting there in about seven rows, and he was up on a platform. And he knew that laughter was important because it gets the endorphin, it releases endorphins or something, which makes us feel better. And so he felt he should talk about laughter. And he had a laughter tape going on in the background while he was speaking. And so that was going on. And he was telling jokes. He only spoke to them for about 5 or 6 minutes because it was too painful to sit any longer than that. 5 or 6 minutes of laughter. And he found out that they had not felt any pain while they'd been laughing. And so he recommended to them to work out a program. And he said, work out your own program where you can speak positives and where you can laugh together. And he went back, and the doctor said the results were amazing. He said people had become hopeful. The morale was high among the doctors. They weren't sitting in rows anymore. When they sat together, they sat in a circle so they could see one another and relate to one another eye to eye. The doctors sat amongst them instead of up on a platform. And every day became a celebration of life. And what they used to do was they used to each say something positive about their day or their week whenever they met together. And it became a bit competitive. They didn't like turning up without a positive story. So the kind of things that they did was, one lady had a nephew who was going to medical school, and the nephew had written her a letter and said this: "Just hang in there, Auntie, and tell your friends to do the same. I'm going to come up with the answer." And it's all because one man had spent a few minutes speaking positively and had just been there for them. That's the effect that you and I can have with people. The lonely person who lives on their own, or the group of patients down the road, whoever it might be. Quite powerful. It's quite powerful. Gladys is the next one. We moved back to Basingstoke from Eastwood, and Gladys is amazing. You know Gladys, probably some of you. She is the best listener in the world. And I used to get times with Gladys and love them. And when I got home, I thought, no, I've talked about myself again. I don't know if you've got people like that, where you go and you want to get time with them, and you think, I've just talked about myself. But they draw you out. She is a wonderful listener. And this, again, is something that we can all do. She is the warmest of people. I was shocked. I thought she was my friend. And then it dawned on me one day, everybody thought that she was their friend. And she is actually, she's got loads of friends. Because she comes up to people and she says, "How are you?" And like, she genuinely cares. And then you think, "Oh, blah, blah, blah." And she leaves you feeling so good. She's so warm and welcoming. She loved people demonstratively. And I thought, I've got to learn about friendship through her. So I used to watch her. I used to watch what she did, and I used to listen to how she talked to people. And I learned to relate to people through her. She treated people with a dignity, whoever they were. Mind you, she is a mercy giver, and that helped. Have we got any mercy givers here? You are brilliant friends. If you've got the mercy giving gift, you are brilliant, because you are non-judgmental and you are full of grace. You don't take the high road, you don't express disapproval. You always give sympathy and empathy. To just illustrate the kind of character that Gladys is, we were at, I think it was a pre-alpha, where we'd got some different people coming in with the hope that they go on the alpha course. And she and I ended up sitting outside. It was a sunny evening with these two guys. They were nice guys, they were gay. And we were sitting talking to them, and one of them said to Gladys, "Oh, I really love your cardigan." Now me, I'm thinking, oh. She said, "Oh, do you? You can borrow it any time you like." That is Gladys. And that's the difference between her and me, you know. But isn't that an amazing, non-judgmental, loving... Like, I don't know if those guys ever did do alpha, but I've never forgotten that non-judgmental response and that warmth and that "I want to be your friend." She's just amazing. We went through a difficult time together because her husband died of cancer, and we were there with her through that. It was very moving. We were there in the hospice when he died. We stayed the night and we prayed with him to bring him back to life again. And he didn't come back to life, but we did everything we could. You don't go through times like that and not go deep in friendship. So we've been through a lot. She remarried a lovely Irish guy, and she lives in Ireland, so it's a phone friendship now. And I want to move on to Sue, also in Basingstoke. Very like Gladys. Everyone loves her because she's a mercy giver. She just loves people unconditionally. That's Sue. She's quite a pioneer as well. There's no time to tell you, but she worked with the Aborigines with her husband. She's Australian. And just amazing stories about eating witchetty grubs and honeybees and all sorts of stuff, sitting with the women there under the trees. You always feel like you're in a warm bubble bath or under a beautiful shower when you're with Sue. Everybody loves it. People ask her to go away on holiday with them. That's the kind of, you know, like you want her to be with you. They take her on holiday. She's open about her own faults. Again, a brilliant listener. And Kath and Marilyn are the last ones. That's Marilyn Denning on the right and Kath Poulton on the left. And they moved to the street we live in so that they could be near us. Their hearts are to serve, and we work together. I would say our relationship is a practical one. It's pulling together. So, for example, when the kids were little, if I had people stay, Marilyn's got spare rooms, so she would have them stay in her house and I would do the meals. We work together as a trio. It takes a lot of stress out of life. If I'm back off a trip, they often put fruit and flowers in my kitchen for me, a little welcome home card. If I go on a plane, they bought me a magazine for the journey. We support one another big time. And, you know, we sort of cook for one another. If we do meals, we'll usually take part of the meal to each other. If they've got anything to do, we will share. We'll pull together. We're like three big oxen in a yoke. Every friendship is different. It's not all the same because people are different. And so just to sum up, I just want to leave you with this. 10 things about friendship. Be an encourager. Be an encourager. I once went on a Selwyn Hughes course and I thought it was going to be big, heavy stuff. He was a top trainer and it was in London, this course. And the whole first part of the course, the whole first day, was simply about being an encourager. That everybody in the church can do this, that we can encourage one another. Hey, you look great today. I like your hair. It's got to be real. But if we start to encourage, we will find it becomes real and we see people positively. And we can all do that. Number two, don't expect people to be like you. Right, let's celebrate our differences. You will probably get on with people who are like you and you will have that soul relationship thing like I have with Mary. But my friends aren't like me. Praise God, you know, because life's too exciting to just get on with people who are like you. Don't expect people to be like you. Celebrate differences and look for the positives. Number three, take a genuine interest in them. That's a cost factor because it's selfless. But to be genuinely interested. Take initiative. The number of people I hear say, nobody comes to see me, or nobody phones me. And my answer is all the same, well, you go and see them. Mm-hmm. Like if you want a friend, you give a friend, give friendship. And it's not in order to get, just give it. Just give it. Take time over it. It takes time to grow friends, so value your old friends. I wonder if there are friendships that you've let drop. And the people who've been very close to you. And I would say, restore your friendship in some way, even if it's a phone call, because you've taken time to grow those friendships. Number six, develop into being a good listener. If you're a talker, you've got to work at it. I have to work at that because I'm a talker, as you can see. Number seven, be there for someone, even when you don't know what to say or do.
Sorry, can you say that again?
Yes, sorry, I'm going fast. You're making notes, are you? What number, Millie?
The one you just said, but I didn't get.
But good lesson. Number seven, be there for someone, even when you don't know what to say or do. Just be there. Just be there. Number eight, focus on positives, not weaknesses. We can train ourselves to do that too. That's a training thing. Number nine, treat others as equals. Don't be judgmental. Give unconditional love. And number 10, love God with all your heart and your neighbour as yourself. It's work, it's cost factor, but it's enjoyment. Can I just take 1 minute to read you a story just to finish on? It's a story about a little boy who was very seriously ill. And this little boy was called PJ Dragon, Dragan, PJ PJ they called him, and he had leukemia, and he began to receive some get well messages because it was on the national news. This was in the States. And he received gifts and cleverly written letters and poems and drawings, all from different people in the nation who took him to their heart. And then the presents all came from an unnamed party. He had got all these things from an unnamed party called Magic Dragon. This person called Magic Dragon sent these things. The special trademark of Magic Dragon's gift was a big green bow. As the weeks and months wore on, little PJ's treatments grew long and painful. But there was one consolation. Magic Dragon's surprises arrived at the house with clockwork regularity. PJ's favourite gift was a stuffed dragon, a friend that became more realistic to the boy as the disease progressed. PJ's father was a Detroit policeman, and at one point he tried to track down Magic Dragon's hidden identity. However, he changed his mind when he discovered the trouble to which Magic Dragon had gone to in order to cover his or her tracks. When little PJ went into the hospital, the prized toy dragon received the same attention as the boy did. When a bandage was put on PJ, the dragon got one too. That little stuffed toy with a big green bow pulled PJ through some of the most difficult times of his illness. Unfortunately, 5-year-old PJ lost his battle. And shortly after listening to his favourite record, Puff the Magic Dragon, the brave little boy died. Hundreds of friends and relatives paid their final respects to PJ and contributed the vast array of flowers that occupied most of the room where his little body lay. As you would have expected, in the middle of the display was a giant bouquet of daisies tied affectionately together with a big green bow. Magic Dragon. If you're reading this book, I want to say thank you from all of us whose lives are a lot different because of what you did. You made no demands on PJ and you chose anonymity to do what you were moved to do. But more than that, you've shown all of us that finding a tailor-made friend is basically little more than finding people in need and then helping them all we can. You didn't mind risking it with PJ. I hope we won't either. Thank you, Magic Dragon.